You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Voices in the Wilderness, a Chicago-based humanitarian organization, was fined by the Justice Department last week for supplying medical supplies and toys to Iraqi children. Today, 4 months after the official beginning of the invasion, Iraqis still suffer from roving blackouts when temperatures exceed 120 degrees during the day. Voices in the Wilderness co-founder and two-time Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly has been raising the awareness of the suffering of Iraqi people under U.S.-led sanctions and has organized many delegations to that country. Kelly, who was in Iraq as a human shield, hoping to prevent the invasion, shares her firsthand experiences during the Shock and Awe campaign and afterwards, as well as stories of her engagement with U.S. soldiers in Iraq.
Perhaps one way to prevent a next war is to tell the truth as fully as possible about this war. And for that reason, among others, I'm very glad to be able to just tell you, in response to the idea of where you stand determines what you see, what it was like to stand in Baghdad and prior to that in a few towns to the south, Basra and Abu Fulus particularly. So perhaps I could begin by speaking of something that we had coined as pre-traumatic stress disorder. In the weeks building up to warfare, there was really precious little that anyone could do. We found ourselves amassing emergency kits and listening very carefully to doctors and nurses who would start to tell us what to do in the event of someone being wounded. And it became kind of macabre but much more realistic when we were putting pliers in our emergency crash kits so that if shrapnel was embedded in someone's body, we could have a hope to pull it out. We had purchased a great deal of bottled water. I was again beginning to feel guilty knowing that, the bottled water that five of us might consume in 2 days cost more than any family I knew had access to over the course of an entire month. We were always feeling perhaps especially privileged, thinking that perhaps the United States wouldn't want to bomb people from their own country, but that wasn't an entire assurance. But I think the pre-traumatic stress disorder that most gripped my heart occurred when I went down to Basra in southern Iraq. It's a place where I had a chance to live for 3 months in the summer of 2000. So I have felt welcomed and connected to families that I know down there. The temperature in Basra that summer was 140 degrees. I've redefined the notion of hot in my life. And the conditions were, in all of the homes, closest to what you might describe as a hovel. But we were welcomed in many homes, and I think particularly of the home of Karima and Majid. This couple, well-educated, had had bad fortunes and had to move 3 times and landed in Jumuriya, the poorest area of Basra, on a street where, because there was no pavement and there were no curbs, the muck that Bert spoke of, the sewage, would go just right into their homes, and they were always at risk of the waterborne diseases. Majid was a mechanic who worked to service vehicles for the oil company nearby, but he never could get enough purchasing power on that job to do anything more than just barely eke out an existence and bring home just enough food to keep malnourishment at bay, and they really had to hope that no one would become ill. And then when I had seen Majid again, he had been sent off to the military, and that reduced his possibility to bring an income. The family was struggling. But one thing that was always a source of great pride was Majid's artistry. Whenever he could, he would create the most gorgeous drawings and paintings, mostly with oil paints. And also, I noticed that in that family, a prized possession was a magazine that had been read over and over and over again. It was dog-eared. It was the only piece of written material in the household, but it was enormously valuable. I want to tell that because some of you may get the idea that, well, all right, there were no weapons of mass destruction to be found at the end of the bombing, and there isn't a connection between the government of Saddam Hussein and the Al-Qaeda network that would pass muster in a court of law. But the United States, in its invasion, got rid of Saddam Hussein, and so that ought to be enough, right? Well, is warfare the only way to help a group of people move toward more democratic governing structures? When I think about Basra and that family with their one magazine, I think that had we helped those families, had we helped Majid and Karima and their children gain education, restore the middle class that once was much more prevalent in that country? Had we helped them with basic social services? Had we helped them with communication rather than with the sanctions leaving them so beleaguered and cut off from all the rest of the world? Then I think actually what happened in Iran when from within a very ruthless and efficient police state was overthrown, what happened in Romania, and I'm not advocating killing, but what happened in Romania when another efficient and ruthless police state was overthrown from within, might have happened in Iraq. I hold out that possibility, but let me return to this instance then of pre-traumatic stress disorder in Basra. I was noticing that in many of the homes that I'd go to, women would give me a kiss on the second cheek, and by the time that second kiss landed, they were crumpling in fear and shuddering and tearful. So frightened were they of a repeat of 1991. Even the men, some of the very courageous and just stable fellows that I knew, were saying, "Kathy, I cannot continue. I cannot go on." Karima, who makes me look like a hefty person, the mother of four, was particularly beset by a malady in that whenever she'd hear a loud noise, this was December of 2002, she would just fall down and sometimes be trembling, and she couldn't control it. Well, when I went to visit in January of 2002, I had oil paints for Majid that I was very eager to bring, but I knew something was wrong. People pulled me aside as soon as I got to the street, and women were tearful. The good news was that there was a bulldozer parked in front of Karima and Majid's home, which meant that that street would finally be paved, the curb would be put in. This was a big step ahead. The bad news. Karima, one morning, put on her hijab and her abaya as she normally would, took a bag from a hook to go and buy vegetables at the market. She went outside her door. The operator of the bulldozer did what he would normally do. He put the key in the ignition and he turned it on. The deafening roar reminded Karima of airplanes that flew overhead and dropped bombs in 91. She collapsed, her head hit the front claw of the bulldozer, and she died instantly. And so now when you visit the home of Karima and Majid, he used those oil paints to create the most beautiful and radiant picture of her face. And that's all that remains. When the first 2 days of Operation Shock and Awe commenced, quite honestly, we started to wonder if perhaps the United States military was going to exercise restraint. We'd heard rumors of the terrific launching that we could anticipate of munitions, and it seemed maybe it wasn't that bad. In fact, people were still out in the marketplaces. There was traffic on the streets, these beloved workers that some of you would remember at the Alphanar Hotel with their white shirts and their black ties, sauntered out on day two with a roll of masking tape to start taping the windows. And I really had to laugh because I'd heard that at the corner hardware store in my neighborhood in Chicago, they were all out of duct tape and plywood and plastic because the Chicagoans were taping their windows. So we were feeling a little hopeful. But to describe day three, I can best do it reading from something I encountered when I came back to the United States. This was a March 21st issue of Army Times entitled "Air War Kicks Into Overdrive." Shock and awe it wasn't until day three. Pinpoint targeting and care marked the opening days of the war, with coalition aircraft flying 1,600 strike sorties, dubbed conditioning work, over the first 2 days. But on A-Day, Pentagon parlance for day three, air power left its considerable impression on the Iraqi landscape. More than 2,000 sorties, half of them strike sorties involving every kind of aircraft we have, deposited thousands of munitions on key targets. Thousands of munitions. More than half of the 2,000 deposited missiles, each missile costing $1 million. So just on day three of that bombardment, $1 billion was spent. I don't think I could ever be persuaded that $1 billion if directed toward the social services and the communication and the education, couldn't have made a difference, a vastly different difference, in helping Iraqi people move toward a form of governance that would be more suitable for them. Day three, described by my friend Wade Hudson, who lives in San Francisco and was with us, was like 11 San Francisco earthquakes in a row, and then the next day it started all over again. Gut-wrenching explosions, morning, noon, and night. The Alphanar Hotel, a seven-story family-owned hotel, was populated by the hotel owner, who was a Muslim man, and his extended family, and he'd invited his Christian neighbors and their extended family. At any given moment, you'd hear an explosion, and then you could see one woman make the sign of the cross and a Muslim man unroll his prayer mat. And we were there with grandparents and toddlers and teenagers and mothers and fathers. We became a very close-knit community. And you could hear, as the bombs exploded, the windows rattle, the floors tremble, and sometimes the building would sway back and forth. The teenagers, and those of you who are parents of teens or remember such, they had gotten kind of obsessive about playing a board game called Risk. It's a military board game of domination around the world. And that, well, there are ironies. And sometimes my friend Cynthia Banas, who stayed in the bomb shelter with the children and the elderly people, Cynthia at age 79, wouldn't have minded if people got down to the bomb shelter a little earlier, but the kids were still playing the board game. And so she one night said to them, "You know, you could always finish the game tomorrow." And little Dima at age 8 looked at Cynthia and she said, "What about Madame Cynthia? We might not be here tomorrow." I was most, I suppose, clued into the effect of this constant bombardment because of growing close to two toddlers, Milada and Zainab. Milada, age 3, a delicate child, still at the kind of weight that someone with my upper body strength, which is close to that of an earthworm, could pick up and swirl around. And she was such an engaging child. And her little sister, 1.5-year-old Zainab, at that point when kids just are starting to learn how to walk and run, and she'd put out her arms and easily charmed all of us. And, you know, sometimes when you meet kids the first day, they're very nervous, and then if you still show up the second day, next thing you know, you're home free with them. Well, their parents would let us walk the corridors with them late at night and help rock them to sleep and play with them all the time. And that's when I started to realize that morning, noon, and night, these two little girls were grinding their teeth. Little Milada's favorite game, one that her mother was very distressed about, was to wave her arm around in the air and sing out, "Tayara, Tayara," an Arabic word for airplane. And then she'd bring her arm around in an arc and thud her chest and fall back in her bed on the floor in my arms, pretending that one of the airplanes had hit her. And when the electricity had gone out completely, and it wouldn't be unusual after the sun had gone down for the mom to be caught in a staircase with a child in each arm and no lights, I'd try to come running as she was groping her way with a flashlight. And little Milada always wanted the flashlight, not to play shadow shows or Tinkerbell, but what she really wanted to play was turning the flashlight into a gun. And she'd point it at her mother and say, "Etetet!" And then she'd point it at me, "Etetet!" And that's again how, I mean, I know kids play war games all the time, but this was a 3-year-old coping with the immediacy of a war that could have taken away her family, her beloved little sister, her friends. I had my own obsession, I guess, that I had to really try to overcome, and that was at the sound of every huge explosion, I would start to think about some of the teenage boys I knew. And they were quite a few, really, because we'd gotten to know these shoeshine boys as kids, and now they were teenagers. And many of them were at some front. They were in fatigues. They were in battle, but they didn't want to be. They were clearly unwilling conscripts. And as days went by, we had no idea had they survived these bombings. And I realized there's no point whatsoever to keep thinking about them, to keep imagining them. It could go crazy. So I would distract myself as much as I was trying to distract the kids. But when I came back again, reading from the Army Times, I saw one line that spoke of the destruction of an Iraqi troop unit, it said that on a given day, 70% of an Iraqi troop unit had been degraded. And I've been an English teacher for a long time, and the first thing that came to my mind was, oh, they got a C-minus on the test. But I read a New York Review of Books article recently, and one of the authors took exception to that phraseology. He said, no, they shouldn't write that the troops were degraded. It would be more accurate to write that the troops were pureed. And that's what our weapons actually do. When the bombing came to an end, I feel sure that many, many Iraqis had been waiting for relief and release, even to the extent wanting the regime to be gone, that they might have been willing to say, okay, all right, it was a horrible bombardment, we endured it, we want to find out about our families, we want to find out about our future. They were ready to exhale. But as one doctor from Saddam City put it, it's now renamed al-Sadr City, an area where the infrastructure just ends and people have lived under abject poverty for many years. He said, it's as though you are waking up from a very serious operation. The anesthetic is wearing off. You feel pain and you feel fear. And it's like awakening from one nightmare and then you start descending into another. And that's how he was describing the recognition that so many Iraqis began to become aware of, that the United States had dispatched 12 armored personnel carriers to protect the oil ministry where the maps and the information were located, but they didn't even know where to find the hospitals, the clinics, the places where there were storage for medicines and for extra food. They hadn't had any plan in place whatsoever to provide security for people. And so as terrible insecurities began to roll in on people, it was almost as though the ground was going out from under them. And one way I have to use to describe it is to say that I've always been familiar with Iraqi people as, in general, the ones I knew, people with gleaming and bright and flashing eyes. But what I kept on seeing was the image of eyes changing color, becoming somber, almost deer-skinned in hue. I particularly think of the mother of those children I described, Milad and Zainab's mother, staring out as the occupation began to grow and grow right outside our hotel window, APCs and tanks and jeeps and Humvees and many, many soldiers in full gear. And tears started to stream down her face as she watched this scene. She said, never before did I think this would happen to my country. And I feel very sad. And I think that this sadness, it will never go away. So I thought, at least I'll take the children away from her for a while, and they won't be frightened, and she can have some time alone. And I thought, I'll take the kids outside. We've been cooped up in this hotel. They need fresh air. And as I was about to go out the door, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. There's concertina wire being unfurled all around the hotel. They could run into the barbed wire. And then I thought, well, perhaps if I hang on to the kids, I can take them out. But I'm sort of hopelessly extroverted, and I knew I would start talking with the soldiers. I'd want to show these beautiful children to soldiers who'd been too long away from gazing at gorgeous children. But I couldn't be doing that because there's a mother looking out at invading, occupying soldiers, and she's in tears. So I thought to take them over to the TV and just distract them. And then I thought, oh, I'm glad I didn't do that, because the TV was showing footage of corpses strewn along the streets of downtown Baghdad. So I took the children down to the bomb shelter. I'd like to say more about the Marines as they came in, however. It was such a confusing day. I think you may know that the Palestine Hotel, immediately across from the Al-Fanar where we stayed, had been hit by a tank round the previous day. And there was a great deal of uncertainty. We learned that the looters, they called them Alibaba, were 10 minutes away from where we were. And we thought that perhaps the government had completely crumbled. We knew that there were weapons stored probably in every direction by Iraqis in relation to where we were situated. And would people pull out those weapons if the occupying troops came in, and would the looters come first? And so we were all kind of holding our breath that morning. We did have big banners that we wanted to unfurl. I don't know if we were thinking of Tiananmen Square or what, but our banners said, courage for peace, not for war, and one very bluntly, war equals terror. We were just in the process of hiding whatever cash we had, not wanting to be the occasion of looters ransacking the place, but thinking, you know, here we were, the Westerners, who compared to everybody else had the most, really. And then we heard a big noise, and it turned out that the occupation was arriving right at our intersection. And so we were ready to go out with our banners, and the hotel owner, I can understand it, he said to us, please, you know, really you are like our sisters and brothers, our family, but why do you not take the banners upstairs? Because, you know, he didn't want to have a tank round blasting right at the ground level. So we went upstairs with our banners and unfurled them. And the U.S. military, they were all Marines in cream-colored outfits, began to come out of the hatches of the tanks and the armored personnel carriers. And quite honestly, looking at them, I thought of Gerber baby jars. They just looked excruciatingly young. And it was a bit disarming. One of them immediately just assumed his perch on the top of a hatch, pulled out an Army issue novel, and started reading in the sun that was beating down on them. And you could see these guys were probably thirsty and maybe hungry and no doubt tired and disoriented. And there we were with our signs, and one of them called up to us and said, well, who are you? And one of my friends called down, well, we're the peace team. And another one asked, well, where are you from? So we started calling down our cities, New York, Boston, Chicago. Are you a Red Sox fan? That did kind of break the ice. And I looked at Cynthia and said, we've got an awful lot of water here. I don't see that they have any. And she said, I'm so glad you said that. Of course that's the right thing to do. And next thing I knew, Cynthia in her fuchsia hat and her summer outfit had a six-pack of bottled water under each arm and was making her way down to mingle amongst these troops and offer them water. So I went padding behind her and thought about an octagonal box of dates in my room and went and got those. And we did what Iraqis had shown us to do. We shared the dates and the water. And I'd like to tell you some of the things that these soldiers said. The commanding officer came over and he said, don't blame these young men for what happened. In the heat of battle, I made hasty decisions, and it's I who will have sleepless nights. Another said, is an African-American man named Harris. He said, I have a daughter who was born with a sixth finger, and I've always wanted to get an operation for my daughter, and I wanted to get me some self-respect in the world, and that's why I joined the military, but I never wanted to kill. And I'm so glad that I was just using this gun to bring up prisoners in the rear. I never shot, but I remember one night there was a car, and it came up real close to where we was at a checkpoint. And one of these guys, he was afraid. He thought maybe there was a bomb in the car, and he told it to stop. But I think they just didn't understand that word stop, and the car came closer, and this guy shot. And then the child in the back seat was an orphan. And he said he could have shot the tires. I read in the Washington Post about another young soldier, an expert marksman, a sniper. And what he did was go to the perimeter of the camp with his weapon, and he shot out the tires of all the cars at the perimeter of the camp. Actually, that was a work of mercy to prevent a work of war. Sometimes these young guys would come in and they'd sit down and watch TV in rotations of three. The hotel owners, boy, they were so proud. They had a satellite dish in the closet, and as soon as the regime crumbled, that satellite dish came out, and they said, we've got something to show you, and it was BBC. I felt a little sad because previously we'd all been sitting face-to-face talking in the tea room, and as soon as the TV went on, everybody rearranged the furniture, and we all watched that TV, just like good Westerners. But these guys would come in and watch TV late at night, but I could tell they really wanted to talk if we went and sat down. They were so forthcoming. And one young fellow said to me, we got to a place where we wasn't sure, was they military or was they civilian, because we saw fatigues on the ground. So we shot everybody, but I hope it never registers here. And I think about that line so much because I was thinking of some of these teenage boys that I knew, and I was so glad when Saif, a shoeshine boy that some of you would remember, returned, and he was all right. But he told me this hair-raising story about how the commander of the troop unit he was with after a battle had been completely lost and many, many had been killed, the commander said, well, if you want to go, raise your hand, you can leave. So Saif and his two friends quickly raised their hand and they were told they could go, so they were on out of there. But as soon as they got outside of the military area, they were eager to shed their fatigues and put on civilian clothing. So as soon as they came across a farmer who could make an exchange, they left those fatigues on the ground and put on the civilian clothes. Would that be enough to put that whole farm at risk? So I think a lot about the soldiers' stories and about the difference between what I might call the works of mercy and the works of war, and the extraordinary amount of talent and cooperation and money and resources that's been poured into creating Operation Shock and Awe and Operation Iraqi Liberation, and how some people in the United States are still bewildered that there isn't an overwhelming thanksgiving and jubilation at this liberation. And yet people, I think, will have a hard time understanding how much people in Iraq have lost.
Kathy Kelly, co-founder of the Chicago-based humanitarian group Voices in the Wilderness, speaking at the Peace and Justice Center of the Unitarian Church of Vancouver, Canada. The event was produced by the group Coalition in Solidarity with the People of Iraq. Thanks to the Trap Rock Peace Center for production assistance with that piece. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammett of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Alex Mitchell at WebActive.com for web help. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. We urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.